For more presentations like this, visit www.xenos.org.
Thank you for coming this morning, taking out of your day to be here. It's an honor to walk alongside with people who have a heart for those who are marginalized at best and just set aside at worst. So I really value this. I came here maybe a dozen years ago with Brett, Alex Steinman, right? Your son back there. And I just told his parents, yeah, since he brought me here, he hasn't spoken to me ever since. So it's taken me 12 years to be recovered, or people to recover and have me back. So I live in Worcester, Massachusetts, and we lead a ministry up there with kids who are in the system. Sometimes people, so this isn't going to be specifically toward juvenile offenders, but some of you have that heart and interest, I know. So just a little broader scope, it's a pretty big group. 1 million kids arrested every year, 500,000 locked up. There's 1,200 detention facilities across the country, about 40 here in Ohio. And Steve's here with Youth for Christ, too. And they have you can raise your hand if some of you are interested in getting into facilities that may not know where they are. But the sad thing is, only about 60% of those have opportunities for kids to hear the gospel. Not like God can't speak to you when you're in a cell, but in terms of people coming in. So a lot of our work is to find people like you who have a heart to do this and connect them with places that have kids that are open and wanting to hear the gospel. We do Bible studies in there. We run three-day gang intervention reconciliation programs called Ready for Life. We run Christ-centered recovery groups. We have reentry programs in a number of our cities in Massachusetts. And we hire, most of our staff have come up through. I love that your pastor was a formerly incarcerated person, and that there's good representative and in the Gospels for people who've come up through that. We run businesses to employ kids, and we always ask them, have you ever been locked up? Oh, no, no, no. Well, then you can't work here. Well, actually, there was that time. They're not used to that kind of questioning. Like, the way you work here is you have to be locked up. So hopefully we haven't created a lot of clients that way. But one of the things we get to do is just be with kids in an honest way, because you're just the people coming in from the outside. You don't have you're not clinicians and all that. You're not part of the system. So I remember this prayer request coming, and we have our volunteers send them in every week. Can you pray for my family and my baby's mother, that she gets through her pregnancy with no flaws, and that my girlfriend doesn't find out where she lives? Amen. So you can pray for this guy. But many more are more like this one. Please pray for my friend Jared. He hung himself Sunday. I pray that he made it to heaven. And please pray that my dad comes back home from jail in 30 days and my HIV test comes back with what God wanted it to be. And that's more typical. So things that kids carry are sort of unbelievable. And sometimes people ask, how do you do this for 35 years? I was a stockbroker and left my job to work with leadership youth, not really realizing it was going to be this population of kids. But I've always seen them that way, leaders, not problems to be fixed. And it's not easy, for sure. But people ask, how do you not burn out? And I think for me it's been, if there's always something to learn walking alongside someone who's gone through a lot more than I have. And I don't ever tire of the courage and the things I can learn from the kids that are part of our lives. And in 1990, we opened a home for kids coming out of jail. That was me in the front, if you can't tell at all here. And my wife and would take in up to 7 boys at a time who were getting out of lockup and didn't want to go back home for whatever reasons. Some you know, knew there were people that wanted to kill them, et cetera. And so 4 of those kids were in for gang murders. And the one in the yellow shirt in the back now, Andre, he's, I think, 42. And he and I just started doing a Bible study in the facility that he was locked up in when he was 18. And so that's a privilege. And I'm doing their wedding this spring. He and his fiance Melissa, Brian, the boy holding my daughter, who last Saturday turned 27, he's my boss now. He's a lawyer and on our board. And so on it goes. The young man in the front with the checkered shirt is a police officer in the city that I live in. So God does great things, and sort of our life verse of our ministry is Paul's words, "You might have had 10,000 teachers in Christ, but not many fathers, but I became your father in the gospel." Fathers and mothers and grandfathers and grandmothers, and now as I get older, these guys all get older too. We had a reunion recently of some of them in the earlier picture, and their kids, which is a great privilege. We'll be with many of them again on Thanksgiving and Christmas, and so we do have this great privilege, don't we, to be fathers and mothers and grandfathers and grandmothers in the gospel. Teachers are important, but there's another place for fathers and mothers. You can't be that to a ton of people, but you can be the son and some, and I'm sure many of you can point to a person that was that for you, right? And so that's the big need for these young people. I'm going to talk today about how to engage for transformational change. Our mission statement is remained the same for 34 years, to see Jesus transform the lives of juvenile offenders. So we know it's Jesus who does the work. We get to see it, but there's also, you know, so what is our part? You know, people sometimes quote Isaiah that, you know, the word will not return void, and yet Jesus' first parable that he tells, and he tells it 3 times, which is unusual because 30 parables, and there's only 3 he tells in all 3 synoptic gospels. John doesn't have parables, but it's the parable of we call it the sower, but it's really the parable of the soils, because it's 4 kinds of soils. And it's good seed that's sown in all of them, but the determining factor is the soil, right? Some is hard, and some is on rocks, and some is, you know, weeds come up. And so I think about the venues that young people are in, are people that you have a heart for as you're here today. And I'm guessing it's probably good soil, in the sense that one of the things that's necessary is that it is disturbed and torn up a bit. And certainly jail is a disturbing place. Your life is torn apart. Be 14, 15-year-old locked up in a cell. That's a disturbing place. Weeds are extracted too. You're separated from all the other distractions of your life. You're sober. And then the other thing is, soil needs to be watered to produce seed. And I love this psalm, "We sow in tears to reap a harvest of joy." And you'll never meet a young person out there that's open to the gospel who won't point to a grandmother or somebody who has certainly sown a lot of tears over that child. And so that's good soil, you know, that the gospel can take root in. And of course, then it also takes time. It's not an immediate thing. And sometimes we get frustrated. You know, why isn't this working? Why isn't this happening? And farmers know, and I grew up on a farm in Minnesota, that, you know, a lot of it's out of your hands, and it takes time before it yields. I'm going to speak to you about transformation. Unfortunately, we haven't done a lot of work on this in the church or even social services. Businesses have done more on the science of transformation, how people really shift in their thinking. Most of us have been more on the behavior modification end of things, even though we wouldn't probably use that. That's a lot of times what the message people get anyway. And to contrast it, at least with rehabilitation in the world of corrections, means to restore to a place of former attachment. But what's the problem with that? You can just speak it up. Yeah, what are you formerly attached to, right? There's not like a going back to something good. For many of them, it just never existed. There's not a foundation for it. And so transformation, by definition, is to become what you've never been. And this is the gospel, right? You're a new creation in Christ. Behold, all old is gone. All has become new. Metamorphosis is the idea that it's a completely new reality in Christ. So this is God's territory to transform and make new. And how does it happen? We're transformed by the renewing of our minds. And even though it doesn't all happen up here, what has to happen down here to reshape the way we think about things? God changes us by changing the way we think about things, how we see things. And so I'm going to talk about that and programming toward that end. Einstein said, because you can't solve a problem with the same thinking that created it. And so this is always challenging because we all think the way we think. And we know that our brains can only really capture about 3 to 5% of everything that comes at them every second. And so the things that I'm tuned into are probably a lot different than the things you're tuned into, which are a lot different than the things the young people you're working with are tuned into. My wife was taking a girl who was aging out at 21 to get an apartment. She'd been saving up her money, which is, you know, $3 a day, $5 a day, and for an apartment that was going to require first and last and security, and you know, what's your record? And she was in for killing her boyfriend at 14, and who was abusive when she was pregnant with his child, and she had an adult record as well as juvenile, and so it was becoming quite challenging to find a place, as you can imagine. And, you know, clock is ticking because at 21, you're out of here no matter what. And so they finally found a place that could be possible. The guy was like, yeah, this place, you know, I lived here, and now my girlfriend and I are having a baby, so we're having to move. But, you know, we'd be willing to rent it to you. It's a good, it's safe neighborhood. You know, there's teachers that live here, firefighters that live here. There's just good people. There's even a retired cop that lives here. Everybody just takes care of each other. And as they left, my wife was like, wow, that's some. And he only wanted first and last, no security. And Lena was like, no, I don't like it. She said, you don't like it? No, I don't want it. My wife came home. She said, I don't know if she's just trying to sabotage this thing or what. You know, she's like, there's no options out there. And I said, well, what did she say that she heard and all that? And she asked Lena, and what do you think Lena heard? What was her 3 to 5% tuned into? There was a cop that lived there. That's all she heard. My wife heard, you know, only first and last month, no background check. Safe place. I hear cop, I don't particularly get traumatized by that. And it wasn't because she wanted to do bad, it was because she wanted to do good. And the cops have all the power. You know, they can just run your license plate, know everything about you. And so they could be, a cop is between her and success in her mind. And so, you know, just knowing and being able to assess what I'm seeing when I see things. We all have biases. And that's how we survive, because, and we'll talk about it as we go on, but knowing that our thinking is getting in the way, take every thought into captivity according to Christ, it's a process, isn't it? So, metanoia, the word for repentance, really just means to change your mind. So, one of the things I want to think about, and then we'll stack into it as we go, is some of the more recent work on transformation of brains come from Jim Wilder, who calls himself a neurotheologian. And he's written a lot on this from a Christian perspective, but one of the things he speaks of in the book, The Other Half of Church, is that in general and simplistically, the right side of our brain is the more transformational territory. It moves faster than the left side, so like 6 times per second, you know, a thought can come there and experience, and it's more experiential. And so it's beyond your ability to put language to or even be conscious of. The left side is more the conscious side, 5 times per second. And so, you know, in most education, and certainly in the church the last 500 years or since the Enlightenment, we've given a lot of discipleship around left side of our brain information, which is not bad. It's good, except if the right side's not experienced and filled, it actually makes it worse. Because, you know, you're talking about joy, and you need to be joyful always, but you're not living in an experience of joy. So you're trying to, you know, what's wrong with me? And so that's really interesting that, like, one of the things that the right side of our brain and our brain is attuned to have to operate in is a state of joy, for example. That's like the operating system we're created to work in and be in. And so also one is a hesed, love and connection. So we're coming out of, you know, this pandemic, and you know, we've been, many of us, really stripped of that sense of real belonging. And then also it lives in a place of a real identity in Christ and what that feels like. So I'm gonna start us off with an exercise that I was gonna end with, but I think it'll be good here. So just think about this whole thing of joy. If it's true that we are created to be in a place of joy, for the joy set before him, he endured the cross. Right? So joy is not the absence of pain. And we'll talk about this, the difference between pain, suffering, which Jesus had a lot of, and we're promised it, and trauma. You wouldn't say Jesus was traumatized. What distinguishes those two? Keep that in your mind as we go along this morning. But what I'd like you to do is to, in a moment, I'm going to ask you to recall. And I'm going to work the right side of your brain right off the bat, even before you're awake. a time of joy, real joy, to where you can recall it and feel it in your body, like know where you feel that. I remember, as an example, my son, before going off to college, I wanted to take him and go do something. And I haven't always felt like we connected a lot. My son is gay, and he's 26 now. And we were just on different pages all the time when he was growing up. And we went away to Western Massachusetts, and we went whitewater rafting and rappelling one day, you know. wasn't all stuff that he loved completely. It was more my thing. But then the second day, we went to two plays, and we were watching a movie at night in the room on my laptop. I looked at him, and he was just, I was laughing. He was just, his face was just beaming with joy. And I have that image of him. And I can feel it, like, right here. I can feel it in my eyes and a warmth in my chest. I just feel that when I recall that joyful memory. And I told him about it yesterday because I was thinking about this one more recently, because I've now got a catalog of about 15 or 20 of those that I've stacked up, because we can retune our brain to joy. So I want you to just close your eyes. So I'm going to work the right side of your brain a little bit, and it may not feel totally comfortable, but I want you to just think about a time where you legit felt joy. It might have been a long time ago. It might have been recent. But you can recall that, and I'll give you a minute or so just to relive it to where you can locate it in your body. It might be like fluttered in your stomach or whatever, but just take a moment and recall joy. So do you have it? And can you locate in your body where you feel it? Your stomach, your chest, your head, your eyes, as you're in that. And so now what I would like you to do is just, you know, if you're near somebody, maybe you guys can flip around. Just tell, I'm going to give you just a minute to tell the other person about that experience of joy. And then where it is that you feel it in your body, and where was God in that, you know, as you look back? Like, where do you see God in that? That makes sense? So some of you may pair up with three or two, but just kind of wherever you are, just tell that. I'm not going to give you much time. So go ahead, pair up with somebody that's near you, flip around, groups of two or three. What was this joy experience, and then where do you notice it in your body? All right. I know there's a lot of joy in the room right now. So what are some of the places that you noticed it in your body that you actually could feel it as you recalled that? Just call out some of those. In your chest. Yeah. Where else? Stomach. Yeah. So it's interesting because, you know, listening to our body, being attuned to our body is right brain work. And like a lot of people who've had a lot of trauma, and I wouldn't put myself in a big trauma category, but I know that I was shut down about feelings growing up because of my anger. I was afraid of it. And I remember on the farm, losing my temper and killing a sow with a hammer, just beating it when it wouldn't go, or and my father saying, "You're just like your grandfather," which was the one thing I didn't want to be. I'd see him beating up my grandmother regularly. We'd have to leave the house at night sometimes when he was drunk and was coming over with, my grandmother said, a loaded gun, get out of the house. And so here I am at 12, "You're just like your grandfather." And so to survive, I really repressed feeling anything, feeling anger, but then you miss everything. And passion, you miss a lot of passion. And, of course, that was a good survival strategy until I met my wife. And then it wasn't a great, she'd complain, "I'm looking for this, but all I get is this." And I didn't even know what that meant. Like, am I broken? Don't I have it? Or what if it comes out? Because I didn't want to kill her with a hammer. And your brain can't really distinguish between the times, and this is part of trauma, is that it doesn't have a time, so everything else gets looked through by that lens. And so it became a real problem in our relationship, and then with our kids, I wasn't to where she just said, "You know, I can't trust you." This is about the time we had, I showed you a picture of, you know, we had two little kids, and seven boys out of jail living with us, and she said, "I can't trust you." So what do you mean, can't trust? Because you're not there for me. You can't be there for me. And I didn't even know what that was, but I knew I had to get at this. And it was been many parts of that, but part of it was counseling to understand what's a feeling. And at first I had to, well, I had to learn to listen to my body. If it's down here, it's probably fear. If it's up here, sadness. If it's up here, anger. You know, I had to learn to, this is right brain work, by the way. And I was always, I didn't want to be an emotional basket case like my mother. So feelings, I didn't have a good, you know, they were just like weakness to me. And so I had to retrain my whole brain because of what it was costing my family. And a lot of the kids were dealing with, have blacked out in anger or committed a crime in anger. So they don't, you know, they're trying to survive by not feeling too. And so this exercise that you did is a right brain exercise. And what you would want to do is like give that experience a name even. So mine might be David, you know. And so collect 8 or 10 of them. I have them written in my, you know, notes on here. And then the practice is before you go to bed, recall one. Just the one that you may have done here. And just be in it for a minute till you feel it. Till you notice it again in your body. And where was God in it? Or maybe the first thing in the morning or some once through the day. This is training your brain toward joy. Because you live right now, most of us live in a state of fear. Right? Our whole culture is fear-based. Be on the lookout. Uh-oh, this is going to turn on the news. Everything is fear. And fear and love are opposite. Perfect love casts out fear. And this is critical for us to be able to have, and then we can give language to it, which is the left side of the brain. And all transformation, real shifts occur on the right side of the brain. They're experiential. So most of us in our culture need to retrain ourselves that way, is my point. And if we are, in fact, programmed by God to live in a place of joy, Paul talks about it, you know, rejoice always. It's not talking yourself into it. This is part of how you can, and that's why the two critical things are, where do I feel it in my body, and where was God in it? If you're interested in more about some of that, this is a really good book, The Other Half of Church. And the book that I have written, Groundwork, is around how this transformational change process happens. So thank you for jumping into that. Does it feel a little more joyful, at least now this morning even? Yeah. All right, so teaching for transformation then. And this comes out of most business literature. But it's, you know, all truth is God's truth. So it says that for people to experience a shift, like not just, you know, more, better, different than the past. Those are incremental kind of changes, but real shifts. Three things have to be there. One, we're teaching content, and it's important. We have a lot of content in the Bible, and we have a lot of content in you know, what people need to know about God and themselves. But there's a difference between teaching content and teaching kids. Would you agree? Those of you who are teachers, if you could just teach content, you just hand them the book and, you know, or have it play at night while there's... No, it's different to teach people because we all learn differently. And the point of listening is not so much what I'm saying. Our communication is not so much what I'm saying, but what are you hearing, right? Because I think I'm speaking this and you're hearing this. And a lot of times they're at a very different level. When my wife was telling me, you know, you're not safe for me. Like, I was like, what are you talking about? I've never cheated on you. I never would. I've never laid a hand on you. And like we, she was here, I was hearing, and she was hearing. We were completely in a different place. So when we think about teaching content, we're thinking about different ways that people learn. And many of you are familiar with, I'm sure, Howard Gardner's work out of Harvard, if you're in education or social work. But just quickly, you know, a lot of times we think about, you know, tactile learning and auditory or visual, but he says there's really 9 types of ways, and a lot of work's been done on this. But the first two are really left brain methods, linguistic and mathematical. You recognize any tests that test these? SAT, ACT, GED, they all do, right? And that's okay if you learn that way, but many people don't. My wife's from Denmark, so like linguistic word, I mean, English is her second language, so if people who have English as a second language, that's never going to be like their number one, right? And you have to learn these two to get through school. And actually, you know, I think about safety nets in our society. A family is the first safety net, that even if you don't learn in these two ways, or how many have a child who you know that this is not their primary way of learning? You figured that out. They had an IEP, whatever. So a family can advocate for the kind of supports they need, and they can make it. But if you don't have a family that can advocate, then the next safety net's a school system, which is primarily working out of these two realms. And if you don't learn in these two ways, you fall through a second safety net. And now, what's under that? Well, something in the community might be a youth group, might be, I know you have a coaching program for some high-risk kids. Sometimes that catches them, but if the community safety net doesn't catch them, what's under that? Maybe they get a social worker, and if that doesn't catch them, then they're in the juvenile justice system. So if you're working with kids in the juvenile justice system, you automatically assume that they fell through a number of safety nets. And this one was probably, you know, early one. So that they know by third grade, they build prisons based on neighborhood's third grade school statistics. You know, the school to prison pipeline. It's right here. So what am I saying all that for? Because people learn in all kinds of ways. One's not better than the other, and it's not like you can't do any of them, or it's only one. We have a combination, but mathematical or spatial picture intelligence is a more right brain type of intelligence. And you know people like that probably, or some of you are, like, for example, I was doing a training for some workers, and one of the guys there drew this picture over 3 days. It was the National Guard runs a program with high-risk youth called Challenge, and I was like, what are you doing? He said, well, this is how I got through school. I would draw, because it was like I had to translate from these concepts to paper. I said, so this is the training I did? He said, well, some of it is, but that's just like, it's like how he could make sense of concepts and words and get through school. You know people like that? Or maybe some of you are like that? Like, Jesus taught in pictures too, didn't he? A lot more than concepts. We're frustrated that we don't get a real clear, you know, systematic theology from him. We have to make it up ourselves based on what he said. But these are artwork of kids. And I remember walking with my daughter when she was little, and we were in Providence under a bridge, and a kid with his drawing there. And we sat and just talked to him about what was on his pages. And he told us everything about his life. Found out he was also in the juvenile system there. So using art is a really important way to teach in concepts and pictures. Boy, you know, you could, if you say what's wrong with you to this kid, or tell me what your home life is, they may not say anything, but if you ask them about their artwork, you'll find out a lot. How many of you say, you know, you can see that you have this type of intelligence yourself? You don't have to be ashamed, right? It's a good, my wife is that completely. She remembers everything by the picture or how she felt it, you know, if she had a connection like that. Musical intelligence can break through to another part of somebody, play a song, and we, you know, we talk to kids who will use music to get up, to beef, or to settle down, to manage their emotions. And so, you know, we have a great history of that in the church, right? Music's a big part of how we experience God and how we teach. Kinesthetic active intelligence. Well, the Gardner would say that a good percentage of the boys who mostly have ADHD, it also happens with girls, but their brains develop like 5 years slower, and so it doesn't work well. It's cute when it's a four-year-old, but when it's an eight-year-old bouncing around, it's not as cute, and it doesn't work as well in the classroom. So we have to manage it or you know, medicate it or whatever to try to fit the system that we teach in. And he found that the IQs of dropouts were actually slightly higher than non-dropouts. So it wasn't like an intelligence issue. He just didn't tend to learn well early in the morning in fluorescent lights and in rows. And like we're, although we have some community here, you know, we're. And so whose responsibility is that? The learner or the teacher? To at least understand, how do we teach to how people learn? You wouldn't go on the mission field and expect to, you know, just take your lesson from here in the language from here and deliver it, would you? Interpersonal people intelligence, we call them ringleaders and problems because they're making, but every group I'm in, there's a leader and it's not me. You know, who's the leader in this youth group or in this crew out here? And I used to just be frustrated by them. And I remember doing a Ready for Life in a Rhode Island facility, and they made every kid come, which didn't work well. And fight broke out in the first hour. And then I noticed as they were lined up, there was one kid who was off differently, and whatever he did, everybody else did. So I went up to him. I said, "Listen, I could use your help." He said, "I didn't do anything. The staff all come right around. What's going on?" I said, "I'm just saying I need your help." He said, "Why? Because you're the leader here." No, I'm not a leader here. Believe me, I'm in trouble all the time. "Well, you might be, but I still think you're the leader." He said, no. I said, "Well, you want to try an experiment?" He said, "What?" "Just this next section, go back in the row and ask two questions. I don't even care what they are. And just notice what happens in the group." And so he does, and then at the break he goes, "Everybody was doing what I was doing." I said, "Yeah, it's because you're the leader. So what do you want to do now?" So we kind of worked it through this painful situation that otherwise was going on with this group that really didn't want to be there for 3 days. So, you know, if you can make it out there with half the people trying to kill you and the other half trying to arrest you, you got something. And why not just align with each other and acknowledge that you're the leader rather than "I'm going to fight you for that position"? That's a painful way to go. Interpersonal self-awareness, that's a type two. And these people sometimes are great at poetry and writing. They see the deeper, dark side of things. Smoke a lot of weed, too, a lot of times. But it's a type of intelligence. You know, Hemingway, some of the greatest playwrights were of this. And then there's nature intelligence. So much of the scripture is written in nature, about nature, and just being out with kids in that space. For many of our city kids, their world is only a few blocks. So they don't get a lot of it. But you'll find some, for me, if I'm in a room that's dark all day, I just dry up. I literally, when I go outside, just feel like I got got air again. You know, it's a big part of how I learn and experience God. And this deep existential, you know, why do we have to be here? What's the purpose of this? That's a type of an intelligence as well. So as you look at that, which ones are right brain type of experiential learning and which ones are left brain from the way I described it? Yeah, I would say like 3 to 9. And so we in the, you know, a lot of people in the church world say, you know, historically the church seems to reinvent itself every 500 years or so. And so it's been 500 years since the Reformation, you know that, right? Just celebrated 500 years. And coming out of COVID, a lot of us are saying, how are we going to do this? We can't go back to what we were before. But what does it mean to be the church today and where people are? And one of the things I think about Dwell Church is that because you're so intentional about relationship and the small groups, that there was a relational glue that held versus some of ours that are just, you know, coming and listening to a lecture, which we could now do online, so why come back in? And yet there's something so missing in how we're wired. And so this is stuff that I think is not just relevant to the juvenile justice or the kind of folks that we're talking about. Jesus taught in all of these ways, would you agree? All of them. So that has to be there. The second part of the triangle is it's got to be fun or safe, and not like rah, 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 but the number one enemy of transformational learning is a four-letter word, cool. If I got to be cool or know the answer, right? I already know the answer is Jesus before you ask the question. But it cuts out transformational learning. There has to be a sense that I can fail with this group and still be in. Because when you're learning something new, you're going to fail. That's part of the process. In fact, all learning comes from failed expectations. You can write that down. All learning comes from failed expectations. So because somebody's expectations have failed and you're in jail, now you're in a learning posture. That's what makes that soil good. If I already have it all together, then, well, as Jesus said, I have nothing to say to you. It's the sick who need a doctor, not the well. So if you think you're well, then, you know, I'm not for you at this point. You're not ready. It's throwing pearls to swine. So people need to feel connected and safe for them to be open to learning, because the old ways that they've been doing it aren't working. And so it's just like riding a bicycle for the first time. Or like my daughter's now 27. She has her license. I don't know how. The last time she's been in the car behind the wheel was on her driver's test when she was 17. She's petrified to be, you know, and she lives in Chicago and public transportation, and so she gets by without it. But now at 27, it's just like too scary to even think about doing it, you know, because it's not going to be smooth when you start off. So safety or fun. So interesting work that was done out of the American Psychological Association that looked at what were the contributing factors when someone really shifted transformationally, you know, from this to this, not just, you know, incremental, more, better, different. 40% had really nothing to do with what you were teaching. So has to do with genetics, background, experience, outside support. Sometimes somebody has a baby and now, like, hey, I gotta get responsible. Sometimes I turn 18, I'm not a kid anymore. They got locked up, something happened, you know, and it's a wake-up call, you know. In the recovery world, it's an ugly scene when the bottom hits. But there's, it doesn't have to do with you. It has to do with them, in other words. So 60%, then the rest has to do with what you might bring. And 15% does have to do with whatever kind of therapeutic technique you might use. And we have one. It's a transformational change model. There are many behavior modification models. There are, you know, identity truths, teaching. It's about the same as the placebo effect, which is interesting, because that just means that, you know, of course, a certain percent of people who take a sugar pill for blood pressure, their blood pressure goes down. So they have to measure that because of the expectation. So what that means is if somebody believes that your program is going to work, it's a better chance it's going to work for them. My uncle went to this AA group and he got sober, so if he could do it, then I can probably do it too. The buzz about what you do. Dwell Church, that's a place where everybody is just known and loved. Okay, so I'm coming in believing I'm going to be known and loved versus, you know, those guys are just judging you. I'm coming in with a different posture. The buzz about it. That's why having kids or others talk about it is more powerful than you talking about it, what you're doing. It doesn't diminish the placebo effect, but we see what we're looking for, and we experience what we're expecting a lot of times. Now, that leaves what percent for the mathematical people? 30, yeah. So 30% has to do with the nature of the relationship between us. So half of what I can have influence over has to do with the nature of my relationship with you. And it's defined by warmth, empathy, a high level of acceptance and expectation. So I have great expectation, but if you fail, you still accepted, right? That's good news, because we can all be in relationship. We're wired for that, to weep with those who weep, rejoice with those who rejoice. And that has the biggest impact for people shifting. Not what I'm telling them. Now, I want to give them the truth. The truth will set you free, but it's delivered in a different way, right? Particularly when we think about people experiencing it. Experiencing love, not getting a lecture about love. Comes out of the Heart and Soul of Change, which looked at all these different models of how people shifted. So then the third one is action. So there's got to be a point of action for transformation to occur. And I think the way we use this a lot is, you know, around vision. So without a vision, people cast off restraint is one of the translations. Another one, they perish. But having a bigger yes than just the no's. You know, sometimes we get, one kid said, I said, well, what do you think it is to be a Christian anyway? He said, well, you don't drink, you don't get high, you know, you don't have sex, you don't, it's like, really? it's a religion of no's. And our brains don't process no. Like, tell your three-year-old child or niece or nephew, don't jump in that puddle. What do you think they're going to do? They're all in, right? It's not an effective way. A yes, and the whole system. I tell kids a lot in jail, you know, you are very valuable in this system. You're worth somewhere between $100,000 and $300,000 a year as long as you keep coming back here. That's how much value you bring. That's what it costs to put you in here. And there's people's jobs. And so the system, every system's designed to get the result it gets. So you keep coming back, that's a lot of win for a lot of people. Now, I don't know if you want to keep playing that role or not. But the way you keep going back is a system designed to focus on all the things you're not supposed to do. Now, nobody came up with a manual for this, and it's not ill-intended, but, you know, it's like driving a car looking backwards. You're focused on all the things you're not wanting to do. Where do you think you're going to end up? Versus, what is it that you want? What is it that you're about? And when somebody gains something of that, it changes all reality. The young man, not young anymore, Andre, who goes in with me on Monday nights to the jail where he was locked up, we used to take kids to on mission trips every summer, and he didn't want to fly, and he was pretty adamant. So we were going to Mexico, and so he had to come up with his own thing, and he's going to work at a camp for disabled adults. And so he did, and when he came back, he said, "I finally found the reason I was born." I'm like, "Really? How's that?" Well, he was a personal care attendant for this autistic man, and he's like, he just told these stories and stories, and you know, ever since then, he's been in that world of running group homes and whatever, you know, for all these years. And so now you got something to work with. And a way that sometimes we think about it is when someone gets a vision and you get clear about it, and it's not easy to get people there because a lot of times their vision is the things they don't want to do anymore. You know, I want to get sober. I want to get out of crime. I want to get my bills paid. I want to get, but those are okay, but what's the vision? Like, why? You know, I want to be a good father. I want to help people. I want to be there for my nephew. And as soon as somebody sees that, you notice a despair almost immediately on the heels of it, because there's a tension between current reality and that vision. And Kierkegaard said, we all tend to find a level of despair we can tolerate and call it happiness. So what does that mean? We lower our vision down to our current reality. You ever notice how you do that? Well, this is just how it is. I don't want to get my hopes up, because what if it doesn't work? So I live in a level of despair that I can tolerate, and I just call that I'm all set. That's just how it is. I'm good, right? Because that tension brings despair. And so how do we walk with people to keep the vision there so that the current reality moves up into it, right? And so all the conversations become around, you know, so what is it that you want? And I remember Brian, the kid I showed you in the picture, was holding my daughter. When he got into Wheaton College, you know, he dropped out of school in eighth grade, but he wanted to be a lawyer like his lawyer was for him, and it was like, I didn't even believe that it's going to be possible. A kid who drops out in the eighth grade was in for a gang murder. That's not going to happen. But he got into Wheaton on a Chuck Colson scholarship, but then he quit going to high school. So he was like this. They were calling, saying, "Yeah, I don't know if he's going to pass." And I tried guilting him and tried, you know, every kind of method I know. It wasn't, but I said, "But Brian, you're a lawyer. He's speaking his life into him, you know, what it is that, if you don't know somebody's dreams or vision, then, or they don't know it, they haven't articulated it, you're just like Dallas Willard said, you know, doing sin management mostly. Trying to manage all these sins versus without a vision, people cast off restraint. My vision restrains me. And so having these dreams, these conversation of dreams, what is it that, you know, God's placing you? What do you love? What are you good at? What do you think about? Did you used to think about before you gave up on it? And as we say in Ready for Life with these three-day trainings that we do, we say at some point we're going to get into a fight here. And we're going to be fighting for you in your dream, and you're going to be fighting against it. And who do you want to win? this is the real, this is transformational work, really. So third one is the necessity to connect before you give content. You know, it's that safety apex versus the content. Both are important, but another crude look at the brain, you know, none of these are fully accurate because our brains are a lot more complex, of course, but that, you know, we know we have a survival brain, our amygdala, sometimes called the reptilian brain, the brain stem, the automatic responses that are in place, you know, at birth in us. And then the emotional limbic brain territory, that's where connection happens. And then the logical prefrontal cortex, the logical part of our brain that's able to have impulse control and all of that. And that part develops most fully at when? Anybody know? 25, 26. Yeah, that's why, you know, you can buy alcohol at 21, in our state, marijuana at 21, go to war at 18, but you can't rent a car till 25. They're not playing around. It's like, nah. I know you got, you look old, but your brain's not ready for this for this car in the parking lot. So, nope. So we want to help, if we want to do transformational learning, thinking about how you think about things, God's transformed us by changing the way we think about things. Where do you, which brain do you think that happens in of these? Thinking about how you think about things. Yeah, the logical. So it's a challenge with teens. Not like they don't have it, but it's not fully developed till mid-20s. But we want to speak into that brain. And one of the things we know is that kids are living in their survival brain primarily. Just adolescents in general, but now when you put them in a high-stress situation like a juvenile jail, in high-stress communities. So they're living in their survival brain. And the thing about the survival brain is it can't think, it only reacts. It's not in its hardware, or software, whatever. It's not able to think. It can only react. So these are the way it reacts: fight, flight, fool, follow, freeze. That's the mechanisms that keep us safe when a threat comes at us. You know, we run, we get adrenaline, cortisol, we lift a car off a baby, we can do crazy stuff when we're threatened. So, this is a challenge. If I'm coming in and just opening up the Bible, thinking I'm speaking to a logical brain when I'm speaking to a survival brain, right? It can't think. So what do I have to do? How do I engage the logical brain? Where do I have to go through? The emotional limbic brain, where all connection happens. It means I have to connect before I give the content. Now, it's really important because if I were to walk into a juvenile facility with Steve here in Columbus tonight, and I just open the Bible, and hey, I want to, you know, show you guys something really cool. And what? So all these kids are coming in their survival brain. They're not able to think about it in that place. I've got to connect with them. But what are they noticing about me walking in, do you think? You can be kind. You don't have to be kind. You can be older and white. Yep, and male. It's like three strikes right there, right? For most kids. That's what they notice, and where? Because in their brain is this amygdala. You've heard of that, right? It's been a lot talked about the amygdala. It's kind of behind our eyes. It's the trust detector. It's what determines if a person's a threat or an opportunity, a danger or a friend. And it gets its information from, it's connected to the hippocampus, which can access all the traumatic events of your life so that this doesn't happen again. Now we're starting to get into some of the trauma things. If you've had a lot of traumatic events, this is on high alert, the amygdala. And it's going to signal, white, male, fatherly looking. That's not good. Hasn't been good for me. Looks kind of like an FBI informant, too. No. Now, it's not even conscious. It's just, okay, let's stay down in the survival here. This could be, you know, they did bring cookies, so I'm going to stay in for that. But, or my homie seems to like them, but nah, I don't trust them. So if I just keep talking without connecting, I'm going to get more defensiveness. It's just not going to be what it could be. I got to connect first. And so how do I connect? Well, we do a whole training on that. But what are ways you connect? Remember somebody's name? Tell a story on yourself? Oh, yeah, I love coming in here. You know, this place changed my life. I met this kid, Ricky, here one time. And he, you're from Lawrence? Do you know so-and-so? Oh, yeah, he's part of our program. What an awesome, you know. Smiling, being comfortable, assuming relationship, because the amygdala is keyed in. It starts at age 3. It's pretty well developed. Children can read emotion on faces. You know, this is a 3-year-old's drawing of a person. Some of you can, you know, where's all the detail? In the face, yeah. The eyes, the mouth primarily is how our amygdala is just like it. So Malcolm Gladwell wrote that book Blink before we ever were talking about amygdala, that people can make an assessment of somebody in a blink and be pretty accurate. He cited these people who took assessments of a professor in college, only watching 20 seconds of the person teaching without any sound, and then gave evaluations of the professor, they were almost virtually the same as those who had them the whole term. So your brain is really good at reading stuff, reading people. Now, if you've had a lot of trauma, it's going to get clouded a bit, right? Because the hippocampus is overlaying, you know, cop who lives on the 3rd floor, dangerous place, I can't move in there. So it's going to get some distorted information, not inaccurate for your experience, but distorted. But the amygdala tunes in, so even upside down, you know who this is, of course, right? But when I flip the thing upside down, he looks like he's demon-possessed. What's wrong with the picture? What about the eyes and the mouth? They're upside down. So your amygdala tunes in here, it looks right, and then when you flip it around, you see, oh, well, that. And that's how our brains, they just work like that. They can read emotion. Children can read it. I remember my daughter saying to me when she's trying to play with her and be on my laptop, you know, she's like 4, she's like, Daddy, 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 why? Smile with your eyes, because I was like, yeah, that's good. I like, yeah, nice, good. And she's just like, can read it, you know? And so we're communicating all the time, and people are reading the messages. So connecting is you being comfortable, too. And sometimes you have to tell your own self, you know? Like, these aren't kids that are problems to be fixed or dangers to be curbed, but amazing people I could learn from. That's going to communicate out of you. So this guy may be saying, hey, you're doing a great job here, you know, but he's communicating to the kid something else. And this is the thing, like we're talking about, normal brains, they, you know, we can only take in 3 to 5% of what's, that we're conscious of what's coming at us. And so our brains have to screen out all kinds of stuff to what's important. An overly sensitized amygdala is using all of its 3 to 5% around surviving and keeping trauma from happening from people that look like you and me. A lot of times, or at least me. I'll speak for myself. As a white, older male. And you have some of those too, like, oh, she reminds me of my mother, you know? That's why I don't trust her. And you have people like that too, right? Like, this person reminds you of, you can't, but you don't want to get near them. Or pastors in general, or police, or whatever category, you know? This is a good survival mechanism, but it works against thriving. So this is a kind of a crude way to say it. The amygdala makes the call whether this person's a potential friend, and I'll go up to my logical brain or go down to survival and not get hurt. And I'll get better information up top, but it's also risky. And here's the thing, when somebody's amygdala gets charged and we start to see threat everywhere, it produces adrenaline, even cortisol. And so once that happens, the adrenaline actually shuts off the pathway up for at least 20 minutes. So think about when you get charged by driving down the road and somebody blasts a horn and flips you off, or a kid calls you an MF and whatever, and you feel that coming, right? That's that adrenaline surge. You only got a little bit of time to recalculate a bit. Breathe deep. If you breathe deep 3 times, that'll start to repress it some. Start to tell yourself another story. It's not about me. Because once that gets in your body, it actually shuts off the pathway to your logical brain. And for at least 20 minutes, and you can do a lot of damage in 20 minutes with somebody, your child, kid you're working with, can do a lot of, because you can say a lot without thinking. Agreed? And training kids on this too, like, listen, who's in charge when that happens? That other person is writing my script and I'm just buying in, I'm going with them. And so physiologically it's this. You with me? Anybody have any thoughts or we'll have questions at the end, but I feel like I've been kind of, I don't know, maybe you know this or I'm fire hosing you, I don't know. But all right, so this is a big one. Remember I said the other piece of the right brain, the right brain is programmed to operate in joy, in hesed, accepting love, and in a deep-seated identity. So focusing on whose you are before you focus on what you do. Who am I? Paul's writings are really clear about this. He, you know, Ephesians is 3 chapters of who you are in Christ, seated in heavenly places, forgiven, held in the beloved, before he ever tells you what to do. Then chapter 4, 5, and 6. Now as parents, as employers, as husbands, as wives. So he doesn't do that until he really focuses on who you are. You could say 11 chapters of Romans on who you are, and then now, therefore, present your bodies as living sacrifice. Galatians is like 4 chapters about who you are, and then 2 about what to do. And so this is really important. Until somebody knows who they are, you can't possibly be what we're talking about as a believer. And it happens a lot with the population we're dealing with. I remember speaking at a church when we had four new guys in our home that hadn't been there very long, and I don't normally ever put a kid up, you know, to give a testimony until they've walked for a while. But this Sunday, there's six of us, four kids, my wife and I in the front row, and so I drag them along wherever I'm going, you know, and the pastor says, well, before Scott preaches, we'd love to hear from one of the young men he has here. And they're all like, what? Kind of waking up. What is he talking about? A testimony. What's a testimony? Oh, man. I'm like, just got to, anybody want to just say something about yourself? And finally, the last kid, Ray, said, what are you supposed to do? I just tell, you know, I'm trying to whisper here in the front row. Just tell them, you know, what you, where you've been, where you are. And do I have to? Well, I can't say, yeah. Can you just do it? So Ray gets up and he tells him, yeah, my mom died of a overdose. You know, when I was little, I never met my father, but, you know, I was in Bible study locked up and gave my life to Jesus, and now I do this, I have a job, I'm going to youth group every, you know, and afterward, the church stood up and clapped. This is like a little Baptist church in Massachusetts. I don't think they ever stood up, clapped for anything. And afterward, everybody wanted to talk to Ray. One lady said, oh, when are you speaking next? I want to get my son there. And I said, Ray, you did a really good job. He said, yeah, it was probably the best day of my life. I said, maybe too good, he said. I didn't push on that one. But that night, he steals the car of our assistant house parent. He drives around for, you know, he parks it in a slightly different place, radio's tuned different. You know, the next day, the guy in the house is upset, you know, obviously. He had a pretty new car and wasn't dented in, but, you know, figured out who it was. Ray. And so this is not unusual, because what happens? He gets put up here on a pedestal, and he still sees himself down here. And that's the word integrity means to be one with one is. So this is a non-integritous position to be in. So what's he going to do? He's going to sabotage it to get back to integrity. See, and we do that regularly. We see ourselves, and somebody else puts us up here, so we don't like that. And youth have more integrity than adults. You know, we've learned to kind of front in life a bit more. They're not going to have it. So find a level of despair you can tolerate and just call that happiness. So he did more than steal the car, you know. It started a cycle, and then he was end up locked up again. So I played a role in that. Certainly, I can't say all the responsibility. But I knew, too, you know, that, hey, this is what happens when somebody gets set up beyond where they see themselves. Now, Paul said, let us live up to what we've already attained. So if he knows his identity, it's a lot higher than the people in the church put him at. But he's not there yet. And I'm not fully there yet either. I certainly sabotage things. I don't know if you do. So discipleship is, do you know who you are? And Paul referring to even the Corinthians as what? Saints, right? And in our culture, we live by this paradigm that what we do and what we have defines who we are. If we were to go around, you know, and introduce ourselves, I guarantee you we'd tell each other, you know, this is what I do. I'm a pastor here. I'm a teacher. I'm a social worker. I'm a parent. What we have three kids, have a position as, you know, small group leader. We may say I have an addiction, you know, if we felt comfortable. And so this is who I am, right? Now, what's the problem with that as it's written here, that way of defining our identity? I just have to shout it out loud, but what's that? It can change? How? Yeah. Yeah, so what exactly? So what happens if I no longer can do that or I no longer have that, then I'm less. That's a big one. I'm defined. Somebody else said something? Yeah.
I was thinking with do, though, that focuses on yourself, not on Christ. So it's that level of actions, and I mean, there is actions to it, but if I do good, this is going to happen where focus should be on what Christ can do for you, not necessarily what I can do.
Yeah. Yes, exactly. So I'm defining myself by all things that are outside of me, in a way, right, too. It's a very scarce model, too, because, as you said, if you give something of yourself, you'll be left with less, right? So if I give to a kid out of this funnel, and he can't increase who I am, or he even assaults it, you know, if I give something of myself, I'll be left with less, and if I give it all, I'll be left with nothing, Jack Hayford said. We live with that fear. So it's a scarce model. It's a works model. It's a scarce model. And it's the model that we've been born into, and it's automatic with us in our culture. Not every culture is this way. Some, like Hebrew culture, people define themselves more by tribe of Benjamin, who you belong to, which gangs are more like that too. But it's not necessarily that much more healthy. It's still defining myself outside of myself. So what does God say? This is who you are, my beloved, my son, my daughter, and whom I think about you all the time. I sing over you with joy. You're forgiven. You're accepted. There's nothing you could do that would make me love you any less. There's nothing you could do that could make me love you more either. You're already seated in heavenly places. You can do all things through me who gives you strength. Everything is working for good for you. Like, this is who you are. And now everything I do and everything I have can flow out of that. It's like there's no end to it. So Paul's really clear. He always introduces himself an apostle, a servant of Christ. He can do that whether he's speaking before the synagogues, religious leaders, prison guards. In prison, he can still be that. That's why he could write the letters he writes. He wasn't otherwise writing petitions to get out of there so he could get back to who he was, because he's not doing what he was called to do, planting churches, except he was just doing it in prison, right? So this is a really big distinction, and it goes against most everything in our culture that defines yourself, you know, outside of ourself. We'll take a break. I have these books up here. They're like $10. If anybody wants any of those, you can also get them on our website, Groundwork. So where we are, halfway through this, but the other goes faster. So this is another non-intuitive approach, is to not wrap it all up for them. It actually works against transformational learning. Would you agree Jesus didn't wrap it up a lot? Go and sell all you have and then come follow me. And you think that guy ever thought about that again? It's a part of our brain program. We call it the Zygarnik effect, just because it's named after a Russian psychologist who termed it, but that we keep searching for answers to unsolved problems. Remember I said all learning stems from failed expectations. So when something's not working, our brain keeps working to find a solution. When something's wrapped up, it can, oh good, I can set that aside. So you ever, you know, you watch a movie that didn't resolve and you just keep thinking about it? Now, when I went to seminary, they taught us, okay, tell them what you're going to tell them and then tell them what you told them. It's the least transformational way you can teach because now it's all wrapped up. It's like a sitcom. Okay, good. Everything worked out at the end. You don't have to think about that anymore. And when we leave it open and undone, our brains keep thinking about it. That's why it says don't let the sun go down while you're still angry, because what happens? You're still fighting all night and you wake up with a headache, right? Or I know I can use this in my brain for good if I'm going to be speaking somewhere in the morning, giving a sermon or a test. I'll look at it before I go to bed, and my brain will keep working. I'll come up with some new illustrations. Sometimes the best ones during the night, and I can't remember them. But your brain will keep working on that stuff. So this is non-intuitive because we really want people to get it, right? And there's in transformational literature, there's an idea that significance breeds resistance. The more I want you to get this, oh, you just got to get this, the more you're going to resist me. I mean, you know that from the way your parents work with you, right? You just have to get this, and I don't want it. Whereas if I back off a bit, like curiosity is the strongest part of our brain. But needing somebody, and this is really hard because it's so significant that they get Christ. But the more I need them to get it, the more they resist me, because it's like, is it about me or is it about, you know, you fulfilling your religious duty? And adult wary kids can smell that out really well. And the way they smell it out is they test it. Oh, let me just see if I do that. Then are you still going to be there? That's like a test kit, you know? So, like, I remember going into a Bible study in a detention center, and this kid's telling me, you know, oh, I want to be this medical technician. They make, like, this much money. And, you know, he's telling me all, I wish I could remember what it was. I'd never heard of it. But I said, so what do you have to do, you know, to do that? Well, you know, it's just 2 years, really, degree, and you know, so do you have your GED or your no, not yet, but I said, okay, so you got to get your GED and all that first. Said, yeah, I said, well, then it's your lucky day because you met me. I said, well, you don't even know what this is. I said, no, but I know a place you can go where, because he was telling me that he's going to be getting out in like 3 months going back to Lawrence. I said, so I first asked him, so how bad do you want this? He said, bad. What are you willing to do? Anything. I said, okay, then it's your lucky day because you met me. And I said, because I know a place you could go. He said, oh, you mean you have to go there? I said, well, what happens when you get out? He said, well, I got to go. I'm going back to Lawrence. My mother's a crackhead. So, you know, I just get sucked in. So I said, well, this is a place you can go. He said, I already been here like 7 months, man. I can't be going to some other program. I said, okay, so sounds like you got what you want then. And I just go on, and he interrupts me in the Bible study saying, so what are you saying? You don't believe I'm going to do this? I said, well, I heard what you say, and I think, you know, you know more than me, but you said you're going back to Lawrence. Your mother's a crackhead. You're back in that. So sounds like that's what you want. And we're back on the Bible study. And excuse me. Says, are you a Christian? I said, yeah, Why? He said, because I thought Christians are supposed to believe in people. Not necessarily. And I said, I believe in you, man. I believe what you said. I'm just saying that. That's why I asked you how much you want it. And you said anything, but then you said you want more to go back, which I get. So, no problem. Now, so it's really undone for him, right? And I leave, and the next week, I'm there, and he's the first one to meet me. And he's like, you still think I'm not going to make it? So he's been thinking about this all week. I said, well, I hope you do. I hope you do make it. I think you got all the stuff to make it. He said, but you don't think I'm going to if I go back. I said, well, what do you think? Yeah, I know, but I can't be like, where are these places at? So I told him, he goes, nah, I don't think. I say, okay, cool. So he again is focused on this the whole time, and then I never saw him again. But this is what you'd call a transformational conversation. Because he has expressed something he wants. He sees his current reality is incongruent with it. So it's going to require him moving up in here. And it is now displayed that he wants to go back to Lawrence more than he wants that. And he has to sit with that. And that's uncomfortable. It's uncomfortable for him. It's uncomfortable for me because I just assume that he likes me. Then, you know, is frustrated and angry with me. But that's the Zygarnik effect working in him. And you need a relationship, but sometimes I have to break relationship that's what I'm saying. In a 3-day training, who's fighting for what, you know? I'm fighting for your vision, but it's not my fight. You get what you want. No problem. I'm here either way, but that's a different kind of conversation than me feeling like I got to give it to him for him to get it. And so not wrapping it all up is important. They have to do that work. And in the addiction recovery, you know, you can't want it more for somebody than they want it for themselves. And, you know, and this is painful for people who stand on the sideline or are affected by it. You know, but it's ultimately not our work to do. So, next, assume relationship. Even though somebody's appearing to not want at all what you're saying, the fact that you're with them means that they chose it. You know, so I just assume it when I walk in, and it's all this kind of stuff, and you know. All the signals are going against me. I'm just assuming relationship. Because otherwise, I'm backed out of it. And it's like, well, they don't care. They don't want it anyway. And that's the only thing I have. You know, I've had 10 kids from murder live in my house with me and my 2 little kids. I've never had an act of violence in my house. I've never had anything. Well, somebody stole my Air Jordans and my gloves once. And I think I know who it was. I remember one kid, like they get a job first, and it was winter, and he got a job at Burger King, and so my wife's like, just let him wear your gloves. I said, every time I give him my gloves, I never see him again. I get nice gloves every Christmas, and then they're gone. So I said to this kid, okay, you can take the bike, and you can use my gloves, but if you lose them, you know, don't bother coming back. I was kidding, you know. I never saw him again. His name was Alex from Boston. It was literally probably 15, 20 years later. I'm doing this program in the House of Correction, Ready for Life, and this guy that's in the training said, oh, my roommate knows you. He wants to see you. I said, oh, bring him, you know, tell him to come down. And it's Alex, the kid who stole my gloves and my bike. You know, you got my gloves? So I can't say I've never had anything taken. But, you know, our kids were raised in that with
older brothers who, you know, are a big part of their life and they're part of their life. And so, but we would go through things with the state where they were like, hey, we need you to tighten up over there because of the high profile kids you got in your house. So, like, what do you mean? Like, overnight check-ins, you know, on them, or searches when they come home. I'm like, listen, the only thing I got to hold these guys is relationship. That's all I got, trust and relationship. If I do that, I break trust and relationship, you know, like why we're here. And I'm not trying to hold them here. They can leave anytime. We'll have those conversations a lot, like, hey, so this sounds like it's not what you want anymore, which is no bad, but it's just, it's not going to work because this, we're here together because we're committed to what people said they wanted, you know, which everything we do is not going to work for you, you know, going to church, feeding the homeless, doing one-on-one discipleship. Some of this may not work, but we found that these things work for different people. So just try it, you know, you can always throw it out. But if you're not wanting to right now, that's okay too. But then this isn't the place for you. I'm not kicking you out. Just like, it's going to be miserable for you, going to be miserable for us. So, like, make it hard to get in and easy to get out. So when they want us to start doing random room searches and overnight awake staff, it's like that. It'll be too dangerous. I can't raise my kids in a. I'm not trying to run a jail here, you know. I only got trust in relationship. William Glasser talks about you never have control, but you do have influence based on what he calls quality world. If I'm in their quality world, I'm present even when I'm absent. And that's the power, that's the only power I have. And that's all that you have too. So, you know, at one time they lowered, with a new commissioner, they lowered our numbers to 2 instead of 7. If we weren't going to do that, and we were willing to go down to 2. This is while we were doing everything else, you know. It wasn't just our sole job, but we were living as a family, eating together. And then they, you know, they changed it over time. But that's, that relationship is the glue that you have. And when you're working with this population, you know, relationship has to do with trust, so... You know, real needy youth, some of you work with those kind of kids. They'll trust really fast, and then they get burned. So the green line, they go down, and then maybe start again. Or healthy youth, whatever that is, you know, that, you know, trust builds over time. The longer we're together. But hurting youth, traumatized youth, is the red line. It's like, it's like no movement. You know, I remember our first mentoring program in 1990 in Boston. You know, we were part of a national pilot of this thing, and so it was a lot on the line. We'd hired a staff, and one of our first kids to get out back in the community, we had a really good mentor who was getting frustrated because this is 1990, so you don't have cell phones and Facebook and all that, so... He would call and set up appointments with this kid. Most time the kid wasn't there, but then he'd set them up, and then the kid would blow him off. And it happened 6 times. He'd never seen the kid since he was locked up, but he'd set up many appointments. And he finally said, you know, I'm going to try it once more, and then it's obvious the kid doesn't want this. So, you know, I'll try one more kid and then, you know, maybe find a more fruitful ministry to be a part of. It's like, oh, great, you know. And so we were praying, and he goes to that kid's house, knocks on the door, no answer. She's like, okay, well, you know, my job's be faithful, not successful. So, you know, I've fulfilled my obligation. So he gets in his car, and then all of a sudden the kid yells out the window. And he comes down, gets in the car, and they go. And it turned out he was there all 6 times that he came and knocked on the door. So why would he do that? Why would he? Huh? Fear, yeah. You know, if I'm going to start trusting you, that's scary. I want to, you know,
is this really? So you'll sabotage it over and over and over. And the thing is, you know, if he's quit at six times, the kid would get to be right about how people are. And the volunteer could be right about how these kids are. So everybody gets to be right. So that always feels good. But nothing happens of substance. Nothing's changing me or them. So, you know, did the mentoring start at the seventh time? No. That was all part of the process. And the thing about kids who are slow to trust is that the loyalty runs much deeper than the average kid too. Like, because we've been through some stuff now. And it's not all been pretty, and I've screwed up and you've screwed up, but we're still in it. You know, and that you may be the first person. And now if I have that trust, I can pass it on to somebody else too. And they'll trust the next person a little quicker based on my recommendation, or, you know, that I think. So I might trust and give them a little more grace than I gave you. And the other thing is, kids, and it's not just kids, it's the people we're working with, need different things from us as mothers and fathers in the gospel at different points. So, like, anybody have elementary kids at home, or grandkids, or niece, nephew? Have you ever heard that's not fair before? Get used to it. Life's not fair, right? We want to tell them. But it's really a developmental important stage of that age, that the world is scary, but adults can fix it. Kids have to get this. And in a healthy way, they get it at, hopefully, you know, age 4, 5, 6, that, yeah, the world's scary, the world's bad, but adults fix it. So you feel like you're playing the role of a referee. That's your role. And it really is. It's an important role, because if they get that, then they move into middle school. And, you know, the things change. So backing up a little bit, this healthy stage of development, it's called a pre-existential stage of development, where kids figure out that life's hard, but adults you can trust. Then they move into an existential stage of development, which is life's hard. Now I go on the playground and I tell the teacher and I get beat up twice as bad after school. So life's hard and adults can't fix everything. That's another hard reality. Then they go into 12, 13, 14, and now life's hard, and adults not only can't they do anything about it, they're stupid and part of the problem. You know, notice almost every show on the Disney Channel, you know, or whatever, adults are buffoons, right? Charlie Brown, adults only go whack, 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 whack. They're the problem. And when my daughter turned 13, I was like, oh my goodness, like just breathing the same air was irritating to her. You know, it's like, oh, we still talk about when she met this girl, Brooke, who I just could not take, Brooke and Sarah, when she was around Brooke. And it's just like, a friend of mine told me at the church, he said, well, see, you don't understand. You have like a tattoo across your forehead that says stupid. And you can't see it, but that's all they can see. And anybody got a 13-year-old? Can you vouch for the reality? Now, she was fairly short-lived in that stage. But now at 27, it's like, you know, it's a nice stage. And then when they have kids, of course, it's even. She's just got married this summer, but they don't have kids yet. So then I'll really be the hero. I know. My day is coming. But kids need us to be a referee. And then in middle school, now the issue is different. Like, where do I fit in? It's all about respect, right? Who'd want to go back to middle school
goodness. You know, I moved in fourth, fifth, sixth, and seventh grade. It was just like, oh, it was very traumatic time for me. Had an ulcer in the eighth grade. I would not ever want to go back to that. But now you're like a coach. You see where they fit in. You know, you give respect before you ask for it, hopefully. And then in high school, if things go well, now the issue is, you know, what's my purpose or why am I here? What am I supposed to do with my life? Those are really good questions that, you know, kids would be asking at that stage. And now you play the role more like a talent scout. You see in them what they don't see in themselves. So our curriculum promise, our drug and alcohol curriculum, it ends with, you know, this process called encouraging words, where a kid stands up and everybody speaks words over them. You know, you're wise, you're a good friend, you're deep, compassionate, love God, and we're writing them all down. And then at the graduation, they're all calligraphied with their name, all these words that were spoken over them. And we have them stand up and read them. And this is hard, because more than many times, some, especially girls, will start to read it and they just break down. They can't say those words over themselves, even though they've been spoken by others who know them. So that's the work of a talent scout. Like, we see this in you. Now, the reality is that the people you're thinking about as you come here today, many of them didn't even get the first thing. So they're still dealing with you needing to be a referee and try to make life fair. I remember doing a marriage seminar in prison. We brought wives in for the day, and this guy Donald, one of the inmates, was really sponsoring it. And then he was just shut down, you know, the whole time. And I was like, Donald, what's up, man? Now we're finally here doing this. He said, well, you couldn't have picked a worse time to do it. What are you talking about? Christmas. Christmas. It's like December 5th or whatever. Well, this whole month. I said, well, what about Christmas? And he tells a story about growing up in his foster home, and he was the oldest of this little brother, sister, and they were going to be at his father's house for Christmas that year. So they came the night before. They get there, and there's all these presents under the trees. His younger brother and sister are all excited, and he has to kind of manage them. You know, he's probably like 7 or 8, and keep them settled down, because they don't open presents until the next day, and the next day they're all gone. And every present is for their father's girlfriend's kids, and none of them are for them. And he said, that's when I learned that life wasn't fair. I already knew life wasn't fair. I just didn't want my younger brother or sister to have to learn it on Christmas. So now he's, you know, 38, 40, he's in prison, and he's still looking for life to be fair, and I can't make it all fair, but I can do some things, like show up when I say I'm going to show up, say I can't show up if I can't show up, keep my word. Like, there's different things you can do that give some resolution to this so somebody can move forward, except just get frustrated, because they didn't get it. It wasn't their fault. Now, you go to the average prison, and it's basically a middle school playground. The whole cafeteria has an assigned seat, not by the administration, it's the inmates. There's a pecking order to the whole place. And if you sit in a seat that's not for you, there's a price to be paid. So an entire, it's like a middle school pecking order, whether it's 800 inmates or whatever, right? You know, those who go and do prison ministry. And talk about respect. If you diss somebody, disrespect them, yeah, you die about disrespect. It's a big thing. So how do I engage with people? Well, a coach, you know, this is where you fit. This is giving them, respecting them before you demand respect from them. That's what you do to move people along. Because basically, in the end, kids can't apprentice kids into adulthood. And others who aren't yet healthy internal adults can't apprentice others beyond where they are. And the hard thing right now is
You know, a lot of the, even the mothers, which you would have said is the strength of a lot of these folks, they're like 35 years old. And they haven't gotten it. And the grandmothers used to be the strength. You got grandmothers who are, you know, in their 30s. And they never got it. They grew up in the 80s, a crack cocaine, whatever. So you have a lot of gaps for kids that are coming up. So whatever we're doing as mothers and fathers in the gospel, we're not replacing biological parents, but we're playing these kind of roles. Like your presence has a lot to do, even when it feels like you're just being a referee or like you're not really getting to teach the Bible the way you wanted to, you know, but you're doing important work that somebody has to do. And then creating experiences. So this is the right brain work, you know, like you did when we started, you know, recalling joy. We know this comes out of the Ohio State University a long time ago. This professor there said that we only remember 10% of what we hear, lecture, like we are doing, I'm doing today. Fortunately, he wrote some things down. We actually remember more of what we read. So if you go back and read your notes, you'll have a better grasp. We remember 30% of what we watch, because we're more engaged in our emotions, and you know we're experiencing that story as my story. Videos. We remember 45% of what we discuss. So we run what's called Bible discussion groups in a circle, and we talk about a topic: anger, habits, hurt, fear, and you know, how does anger show up for me? What do I do when I get angry? What do you do when you get angry? How many are in here for something you did when you're really angry? If you had an anger thermometer 0 to 10, and 10 is out of control, how many have ever been at 10? How many are in here for something you did at 10? Over half the kids raise their hand. How far does the anger thermometer go down when you're not mad? Most kids say 7, 8, 6. You know people like that? It's like, you know, somebody flips you off, somebody makes some remark, and you know, if you're at 3 or 4, you go up to here. But if you're at 7, and see, 10 is too late for anger management. Like 10 is what, you know, I have scars from punching my fists through windows, 3rd grade and 4th grade. That's what you do at 10. 10, you black out. 10 is too late. 10, you know, your logical brain is shut off. You're all in your survival. 10, 10's a problem. And you maybe know kids like this. We ran a residential program, and you like be in the cafeteria, and you know everything seems to be fine, and then all of a sudden, boom, 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 there's just like an explosion out of nowhere. It's like, what the heck is going on here? You know, it just like, so when you got a bunch of 7 baselines, you don't have a lot to work with. So how do we lower that base, you know, down? And processes like teaching them how to have joy memories and retraining their brain back into that joy. That's a way to lower it. Most of the things that put a floor there is rejection from people that are close. So, you know, if I'm going to be in relationship with them and we're going to live through some sabotaging, that starts to lower it. Then I can see God, you know, can I really begin to experience God as loving Father, real Father? That's the work of lowering that down. So this all can happen in a Bible discussion group about anger. Now, I don't really give the answer until everybody's asking the question or sees the problem. Yeah, anger's my problem. That's why I'm here. Okay. So, do you think it's a sin to be angry? Oh, yeah. Well, what about Jesus? You know, he turned tables over and stuff. You think he was angry? So now, like,
I don't know what to do with my anger. And I've been trying to just stuff it, but so now I give a scripture when someone's asking a question. And it could be, the Bible says, don't let the sun go down while you're angry. What do you think that means? What happens when it goes down? What does it do? It's like a balloon. You might illustrate it that way. It keeps getting more and more, but eventually it explodes. So that's a powerful teaching method to work with anger, as an example. And we'll remember 45% of what we discuss like that. So I think that's a more powerful way to teach. Role playing is a, we remember 60%. Does somebody have a Bible? A hard copy one? I have it in my. You do? Okay, thank you. So I'll give you an example. Are four people willing to come up and help me with this? Okay, come on up. Yeah. Who else? Oh, thank you. And we need two more. You will too. Good. Come up. And one more. Yeah, the women are really stepping up here. Here we go. Here we go. All right. So I'm gonna read you a story. You remember the story about Paul and Silas and Timothy and Barnabas? It's Acts. Is it Acts 15? I think it might be Acts 15. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to read the story, and then I'm going to have you guys sort of just be in that as them. Wait a minute. Acts, what did I say, 15? I think that's where it is. Wow, you got a lot of good notes in here. My goodness. All right. Okay, here we go. So here's how it reads. Sometime later, well, let's first of all, who wants to be Paul? You be. Who wants to be Barnabas? You? Silas. You? And Timothy. Okay. So just think about these roles, all right? And you don't have to memorize the words, but just how it might have felt being those people. So sometime later, Paul says to Barnabas, let's go back and visit the brothers in all the towns where we preach the word of the Lord and see how they're doing. Barnabas wanted to take John, also called Mark, with them. But Paul didn't think it was wise to take him because he had deserted them in Pamphylia and had not continued with them in the work. So they had such a strong disagreement that they parted ways. And Barnabas took Mark with him and sailed for Cyprus. And Paul chose Silas. Oh, so I'm sorry, you're not. So Timothy's not in here. Wrong story. So you're instead Mark.
Oh, sweet.
It's Mark. And you're Silas. Okay. Yeah, wrong story. They had such a sharp disagreement. Paul chose Silas and left and commended by the brothers of the Lord to the grace of the Lord. And he went to Syria and Cilicia and strengthened the churches there. So Paul ended up choosing Silas, and Barnabas went with Mark. So everybody know who you are and all that? So come up here and just have a conversation with each other about how you're feeling about this. Paul, how you feeling? And look out at them so they can see it and each other, but, you know.
We have a really great opportunity here. I think that God wants us to go back and see these churches and see how these people are doing. So I want you guys to come with me. I think we need to go encourage these people.
Yeah, so the problem is that Mark is here too.
You left us. You weren't part of the program. And so I think it would be probably better if I take some other people and maybe we'll work on this a different time.
I just left because I had other things to do, but I feel like I should still be allowed back in.
Nah, I think the commitment wasn't there that we're needing at this time.
But I think you're right in what you want to do. I don't think you're seeing how much God has changed Mark's heart, and he really deserves to be a part of this group as well.
Well, I hear you, but I haven't seen that, and so maybe we need to, you know, I think maybe at this time we just go two separate ways, so how about
you? That's fine. I'm going to take Mark, and I'm going to go over my way.
I love you all, but I think we have other work to do, so I'll just take you. Come on, let's go.
All right, so stay up here. That was good. Where's that little handheld? Is that up here somewhere? The microphone? I want to ask you some questions. So, thank you. Come on up here. So, now I'm guessing that as you got into these roles, there was something of you that was in that role. It wasn't just, you know, 2,000 years ago. So Mark, how does Mark connect to you? Have you ever felt like Mark before?
Like where maybe people were holding it against you, what you did, or, you know, looking beyond?
In what ways can you relate to Mark, just in like what happened here?
I don't know if I can think of like specific instances, but there's definitely just like, I think we all have kind of a fear of like being rejected or left out, and that can kind of like cause us to have like a pretty strong emotional response usually.
So did that happen for you? Did you feel that?
Sure, yeah.
Yeah. So you could relate to that feeling of being overlooked. Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, thank you. And Paul, what's your name?
Ellen.
Ellen. So Ellen, could you relate to Paul and what he was feeling at a point where that's hit you as well, like people aren't really stepping up?
Yeah, because... yeah, definitely, because I think over time, and I'm like you, I'm older, so I think sometimes you have to really go with what you know is the right thing to do and try to be kind to people, but move on instead.
Yeah.
So.
Thank you.
And Paul is my actually favorite dead person ever, so. except Jesus, so this is kind of fun.
It's good. Now, Silas, what does that feel like? What did you feel like? Can you relate to Silas in this? And if so, what part of?
Just like the tension of like, clearly this guy did do something wrong and there is grace for it, but there's already this assumption of who he is because of that action. And I think there's been often times that I've seen where being stuck in the middle of an awkward situation where you see someone's potential, but you don't necessarily know how to advocate for them.
Yeah. And so you were sort of like picked up by Paul. You were pretty silent in it all, but like, could you relate to how that might feel like, just to be, you know, last one picked or whatever, you know?
Bottom of the barrel type of thing, yeah.
What's that?
Yeah. Bottom of the barrel type of thing.
Yeah.
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 Where it's like you're not necessarily the one that they wanted, but you're still pretty good.
Yeah, that doesn't feel great, no. And Barnabas, so how can you relate to Barnabas? What's your name?
Amy.
Amy.
Yeah, I was actually surprised. Like, I was getting feisty. Like, I was really getting angry there. And I feel like I can relate in terms of, you know, the leaders or the people in charge have a vision, and yet it's not really connecting with the human needs of other people. And so I can find myself being at a real tension point where I can be like, okay, well, you do your thing. I'm going to go take care of people.
Yeah. Yeah. Thank you. Wow. Thank you, guys. So this is what's called a bibliodrama. Thank you for... And we do it just as I showed here, in a short story where people can access that character and how that felt. So you may be familiar with Ignatius, who was the founder of the Jesuits. And this is the process that he had people go through in discernment to be priests, that they would take, particularly in the narratives, and put yourself in the story. You know, it's the, what's it called, where you read it three times and sort of see who you see in the story? All of a sudden, I can't think of the practice. I'll think of it. But it's a spiritual practice where you put yourself in the story. And who do you most relate to? And, you know, as I do that, I find I'm almost always opposed to Jesus and what he's doing, you know? Like, that blind guy, you know, he's been here forever. You're on your way over here. There's people waiting, and he's making noise, and come on, let's go. So this is one way of teaching the Bible. It's not the only way, but it's a role play of it. So we're not, like, memorizing lines, but we're actually in those characters. Right, and we remember, not surprisingly, 60%, because we now feel that, and those of us even watching, how many could relate to somebody in that story? Like, oh, that's me. You know, I feel like that a lot. So, role play, structured experiences. That we remember 75% of those, and 90% of what's a direct purposeful encounter. So what are direct purposeful encounters? Those are like mission trips, right? So we're talking here about how we might engage with youth, and some of us met yesterday, and oh, is there a way we could do community service with kids who get assigned to that, or be a life coach with some of these kids? That's like putting myself in there, into that space, and I'll be impacted by that. The others will too, but it's a 90% retention. So what we do with kids, like these are some of the girls in our program in Worcester, and they go out and on Fridays and they feed the homeless in our city. And these are all, some of them are still locked up and they're going out on a pass to do this. That's a direct purposeful encounter. Now, they may not come to a Bible study, but they want to, and they're getting something, and then they debrief it. You know, they've run birthday parties for people that are homeless and in the woods. And these girls are changed. Now, in one of our programs in Lynn, Massachusetts, it's the third most violent in our state, and our director there started to pull together the leaders of the major gangs for breakfast once a month in her apartment. And they talked about what you'd like to see in your city. And they said the same things we would say, safer streets and safer parks, and our mothers can go out at night without being afraid, and nieces and nephews. So they had this idea of putting basketball hoops back in the parks. They've been taken out by the police because of the gang violence. And so the mayor is in the white cap there, and they're talking to him about this with us, about getting the hoops back in. He said, well, it's because of all the gang stuff. He doesn't really know he's talking to such as they are. But they said, oh, we'll make sure there's no violence out here, and they did. That was a dozen years ago now. They came up with the idea, what if we could do a basketball tournament with all different gangs, 12 gangs, and they'd 56 youth show up from 12 different gangs and navigated the whole thing, and there was no violence. They even mixed up the teams. So these are direct purposeful encounters that we give people the opportunity to be in and lead in. And they're a little scary, you know, because what if it doesn't work out?
And that's where, you know, you come with them and say, hey, how are we going to manage this, you know? And it's not going to be you who does it. It's going to be them. And then I would say this one, final, is writing a different ending to a traumatic story. So you remember how I said that the right side of our brain works? What's the difference between something being traumatic and something being painful? And it's the way the story ends. So if something ends traumatic, it gets written as a trauma in your brain. If it was painful, like Jesus went to the cross, but he maintained in relationship with God and, you know, some of the women that were there, his mother, and it was horrific, but it wasn't a traumatic story. He'd already worked with the ending, you know, in the garden. And so how does that happen? You know, this is the reality. Kids in lockup, 87% have been shot or shot at. Almost 9 out of 10. So that's traumatic if you've been shot or shot at. I haven't. I can't speak firsthand to that. 67%, 2 out of 3, have witnessed somebody being killed in front of them. I haven't experienced that. It's about the same rates of PTSD as those returning from Iraq, Afghanistan. Only it's not a post-traumatic stress. It's an ongoing one because it's still there, you know. So it's you're not like, oh, that happened over here. Now I'm in a safe place trying to navigate it. So these are horrifically traumatic stories. And how do we heal from those? So one of the things we know, right side of the brain again, is that if I have a way to go back and connect to that story with a different ending, my brain will like splice onto it. Doesn't remove everything, but it splices a different ending onto it. If those of you who are familiar with 12 steps, this is what step 4 is of a resentment inventory. You write a resentment, and then you write, you know, what did I contribute? Where was I angry? Was I fearful? Where was I dishonest, etc. So you write a different ending to it. Then you read it to your sponsor, step 5. Then you ask if I'm willing to be free from all of these defects of my character, which all become remarkably the same. And then I ask God to remove it, you know, step 4, 5, 6, and 7. Then step 8, I think about all the people I've harmed. And then step 9, I go to them and I make amends. Now, when I do that, it puts a different ending on the things that drive me back to addiction all the time. It's very right brain experiential, the 12 steps are. A lot of people go to recovery groups their whole life, but they never actually do the steps. That's all left brain work. Read the book, get the concept, but haven't done it. It's the experience of doing it that is where the freedom comes. So I want to have us just think about like a story in your life, an event where you were a victim, like not like you were victimized, like you were abused as a kid, or, you know, not even one like where you were pulled over wrongly, you know, a race issue, but more like you got played, you know, like you got blamed for something you didn't do. Does that make sense? Or something went south and it's like you, and it keeps coming up too, somewhat like, man, yeah, I really got played about that. And so, you know, example, we were given a property some years ago to build a youth reentry program on. And when I went to the town and the first town meeting, there were all these people there with these signs, "Stop the prison." And I was like, wow, I'm glad we're in this
meeting because we're not doing that, so we should skate right through. Well, it turns out it was us. They were protesting. Somebody had heard we wanted to go in there. We were given land, and so they put out a letter to everybody in the town that there was a sex offender prison coming in under the guise of a Christian ministry. So the whole town was out, like packed out. And every time we'd speak, people would boo and get out of here. We don't want you. I mean, it went on to where someone said they saw a spotted turtle and a four-toed salamander. So I spent $50,000 we spent in environmental studies and all of this. Eventually, we just had to walk away. I mean, it was like it wasn't going to go. And I was getting death threats at my house, too, on my phone. So who would say I was a victim? I got played. You can raise your hand if you think I did. And who would say, no, I don't think so. Can you be honest? Yeah. So that's what I'm going to have you do. Just with somebody, just think of a story where you got played. It might not be as dramatic. You didn't lose 50,000, but, you know, you got passed up on that promotion. It should have been you. You got blamed for something you didn't do. You got, you know what I'm saying? So you good with that? Try it out. I'm not going to have you share it with the whole group, but I want you to pair up with somebody. I'm only going to give you not too much time. So one of you will share, and then I'll just have you, I'll give you like a minute or so to share, and then I'll stop. And what I'm going to do when I stop is say, do you think that person was a victim? Did they get played? And if you do, then you raise your hand. If you don't, you don't raise your hand. That's all it is. Make sense? So one of you think of a story. Yeah, man, I got played. I got blamed. I got overlooked. I got set aside. I went in to ask for that raise, and instead they fired me, you know. That kind of stuff. Good? All right, so go ahead. Just with someone near you, and try it out. I'll give you whoever has a story can go first. All right. I know you may not have finished all the way, but hopefully the listener got enough. So if you as a listener believe that this person was a victim here, then raise your hand if you think they were a victim. Okay. Awesome. Thank you. Now, second person, and if you have three in your group, you have to move it a little bit quicker. But now you tell one of yours, and we'll do the same thing. So go ahead. Give you another minute, two to do that. All right. So, how many of you who listened this time would say that that person was a victim? Raise your hand. So, yeah, they definitely got played. They were a victim. All right. So, if not, raise your hand. If you say, I'm not quite sure about it. Okay. Good. Honest feedback is. Now, what did it feel like to tell that story? Relive that victim story. What were some of the feelings? Huh? Embarrassed. What else?
I felt
stressed all over again.
Angry.
Confused. Helpless. Sorry? Sorry. Cried.
Frustrated.
Hurt my pride. I'm sorry. Thank you. It's hard to, when you can't read people's lips, it's hard for me to hear. Yeah, it doesn't feel good, right? Play that. Now, I'm going to ask you to think about a rewriting of that story where you're taking full responsibility for the part you played. Now, that doesn't, I'm not saying that you're to blame for it. I'm not even saying it wouldn't have happened the same way. But you're just taking full responsibility for the part you played. So that may be 1%, but you're taking 100% responsibility for the 1%, right? Just playing that. And so, like in my story, I was asked
when I went into that town. I'm telling the same true story, but I'm focusing on some other aspects of it. I was asked, you know, what kind of kids are you going to bring here? And I said, well, disadvantaged youth. Well, what does that mean? Like, what have they done? Have they committed crimes? Well, yeah, but not like real serious, you know, like they've got a lot of challenges, and we've been running programs like this for a long time. We've never had incidents in the community. And so, like, murder, drug dealing, rape, not rape, not that. And they kept asking me questions, and I was vague because I was like, man, I don't want to out these guys, or they'll probably tell me no. So of course they just go on the website and look up, you know, Straight Ahead Ministries, and like, oh wow, they work with some pretty tough, high profile kids. They're not being honest with us. So, you know, when you don't get clear information, you come up with your own, right? And so a group forms that's trying to protect the community, and they're like, we got to keep these people out. I mean, this person is not being honest with us at all. And so the more I kept going and the more they kept asking me, the more vague I was in my response. And I see that as a big, big contributing factor. I don't know if it would have gone different if I would have been more honest and upfront, not try to protect myself and what we were trying to do. But I do know that the people there had reason to distrust me because of how I responded to their questions. And it was an expensive lesson, $50,000. But who would say I'm taking full responsibility for the part I contributed in what happened? You can raise your hand. And if you don't think so, you can raise your hand. It's fine that way too, yeah. So that's what I'm talking about, like retelling the story. I remember one kid telling a story in Bible study about how he got out, and, you know, he was with his boys, and like, no matter what you do, you can't really, cops are waiting for you. He got in a car with his friends, cops pulled him over. They found a gun in the trunk, and they nailed it for him. And I was like, wow, that's a pretty good victim story. So what are you talking about? And I asked him, can you retell it where you take full responsibility? He said, well, it wasn't even my gun. I said, I get that, but like how you contributed to what happened. And he says this, well, when I got out, I was supposed to stay at home. I was on a, you know, house confinement, but I told my mom I was going down to my aunt's house, and then my boys are going to pick me up. And when I got to the car, I was like, my boy's there and with another one, and I'm like, oh, man, I don't know if I should get in because he's always got a gun. But I didn't want to say something, look, you know, like I was downer. So I got in, but then we're just cruising, and all of a sudden the cop comes up, pulls us over, and I took off running, he said. And then, of course, they got suspicious, and they searched the trunk, and there was a gun. And so they figured it must be mine because I was the one that went running. So I said, oh, okay, so that's what I mean. Like, I'm taking full responsibility for the part I contributed. You know, maybe I wasn't to blame that time, but I had been. They had reason to suspect me. I wasn't clear in my request. This is not easy to do because whatever story you told, you probably told it many times. And so this is like looking at it from a little different lens. Like, true story, but now you don't even have to believe that you were, this is the good part, that you were, had a responsible role, but you're going to tell it in a way that you still get that listener to agree that you're taking full responsibility. Even if you don't believe, you're just going to try it. That makes sense? Okay, so take a minute and first person go again with your story, and now you're going to take full responsibility for the part you contributed. If it's only 1%, just own that. Okay? So, go ahead. All right, so I know you may not have gotten finished, but the listener, did you get that they're taking full responsibility for the part they contributed? If you say they were, then raise your hand. Wow, it's pretty impressive. So you know how to do it. Now you go, if there's three of you, so you're going to have to move through all of you a little bit quicker. So now the listener, tell yours in the same way. Go ahead. All right. So if you listeners believe that this person taking full responsibility for the part they contributed, then raise your hand. I think they were. Okay. So what did it feel like to tell it that way? Vulnerable? Yeah, thank you. Humble. Okay. Freedom? Okay. More workable. Yeah. Any other? More honest. More human.
Kind of lessened the negative impact, just made it feel like this is not that big of a deal.
Ah, lessened it, the negative impact that it's not as big a deal after all. Yeah. Well, what your brain has done is like it's actually spliced on another ending to the story. And this is what moves things from being traumatic to painful. It's not like a one and done necessarily, but like many studies have been done with like colonoscopies back before they were putting you under. But when it ended, you know, uncomfortable, ended, and then you were done, versus another group that it was uncomfortable, and then they sort of lessened it, and then gave you some time where it wasn't, where it was fine, and then said it was over. The second group, almost all signed up for their next colonoscopy. The first group, none of them signed up. So how something ends. So when my son's, you know, coming out ended in a very painful way and abruptly with church and all that, he today says, I'm no longer a Christian. There's nothing that has come good of faith for me. That's his assessment with how it is and how it ended, how it is now. Traumatic events, like, it's the Zeigarnik effect, and you keep focusing your 3 to 5% on that event over and over and over, and you read other things through it. So if I just really don't want to be run by this thing anymore, then part of what our opportunity is to write a different ending. And owning the part I contributed actually brings power and freedom. It's not a one and done, but journaling can do that. Talking to a therapist can do that. But when it's done with a human story like you did in front of somebody else, it's a powerful thing that happens for us. Does that make sense? This is a right brain discipleship activity. AA, they call it sweeping your side of the street, you know. You know, Jesus would define it, you know, the truth will set you free. And if it's, and they're both true, but like the victim story is not altogether true, right? So I wish we could do more with that. Unfortunately, run out of time, but I honor you for stepping into it in that way. And it's hard because we're biased to either see ourselves in the story of the victim or the victor or the hero, but never the villain. So now you're retelling a story where you could be seen as a villain, but it's actually a way to freedom, just owning the power. And I asked the kid, you know, after he told her about the gun in the trunk, how do you feel? He said, I feel power, because I thought there was nothing I could do to
keep from getting arrested. The cops had all the power. Now I see that I had power in it. It's splicing a different ending to a traumatic event. So is there one question or thought? No, yes, sir. Mm-hmm.
What is the difference between these? Like, stay away from blaming the victim, but do what you're
Yeah, so, and it's an internal work. It's certainly, I was sexually abused as a child, so I'm not going to, you know, like put that on me, like, oh, I got to own this. No, but Dan Allender said, you see when someone really comes free, when they stop using their abuse as a story for their entitlement. Like when I can own now, it's not what happened to me, but what am I doing with what happened to me? Like is where freedom starts to come. So it's not going to work for me to call you responsible for whatever happened to you, but you know, we might set a, if you want to gain freedom over it, how might I own the whatever little part, if it was little, that I contributed into that, because things generally just don't happen in an isolation. You know, and if it wasn't, how am I been using that victim story to continue to be able to be a victim, to be entitled, to have license to do whatever I want, to not take and own responsibility for where I'm going and to stay stuck? Those all have benefits that keep me stuck. You know, I get payoffs for that too. Yes. Yeah, how do you stay patient in that? I think, you know, honestly, I think doing this kind of work in myself, like I'm in the process too, you know, some longevity that also not feeling like I'm responsible for that person. What they do is for them. I don't want to be harmful. I'd like to be helpful, but I burn out when I either take too much of it on me or I feel like I can't do anything, you know? And so those are both things I have to work on in myself. Like, this is not about me, but God's got me here. And whatever this person takes or doesn't take, that's for them. And I've done it long enough to see that little things way, way back that somebody did, you know, have an impact, believe it or not. You know, God's the one that does the increase, but that's a really good question. Yeah.
With the situation with Ray, how do you encourage without the risk of sabotaging?
So with Ray, how would I kept that from sabotaging?
Yeah, like how do you encourage? So like one of my spiritual gifts is encouragement. I'll encourage you for everything, and then sometimes I'm like, whoops, I should not have done that. You know.
Yeah. Yeah, I think if I was going to do it differently with Ray or in your situation, I would just have talked to him about it, you know, and just said, hey, you know, I'm wondering if this, you might have felt set up. Oh, no, but, you know, because, you know, you didn't want to, and I put you up there, and I'm not like it's my fault, but what was going on in your mind? You know, you said maybe too good. What was happening? Like, I would just more try to honestly engage it. So if I'm having a question about it, let me just ask that question without blame or shame or I'm all bad or you're all bad. Like, just those are where learning happens. So I would just be more curious, I guess. Yeah. Yep.
What does it look like for somebody to forgive somebody who traumatized them?
Yeah.
Maybe some misconceptions that people have.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. So, you know, forgiveness is not excusing it. It's not saying it wasn't right. It's not giving a... forgiveness is a gift I give myself in the end, right? So retelling that story is a gift you gave yourself. You didn't let someone off the hook. But unforgiveness, as it says, mixing poison for your enemy, and then you drink it. So you're paying a price for it. So... You know, someone said forgiveness is giving up my right to a different ending. So I'm gonna forfeit this ending and my right to have that ending that I was the victim. I'm gonna give that up for another ending that is also has truth in it. Forgiveness is not even necessarily trusting again. It may be not trustworthy to be with that person. I can forgive, and I don't have to put myself in the same situation. But I can be free. To forgive in the Greek means to send from. So it's like this thing is holding me. And whenever you start to move toward a new future, it ignites the past. And until you heal from the uncompleted past, unhealed past, you'll keep recreating it in the future. So forgiveness is... You know, people say, well, why you keep talking about this from when you're 8 years old? Because it's still, the Zygarnik, until that's, your brain's not going to let it go until you either can forgive, release it, mourn it, or own it, you know, in another way, like owning my part in it. Those are the way your brain says, okay, we can let that go now. Otherwise, it's wired to keep you from getting hurt again. So it's going to keep it in front. And the more hurt you have, you see everything through that lens. So this is a way that God's given us to care for ourselves, I think.
So the list of like 8 presuppositions you have up there, all of those make sense to me. And I think, you know, I believe all of those, like except number 5. And, you know, so,
oh.
Like,
oh, yeah. I didn't even talk about this slide. Yeah. Well, just the belief that God has already provided what's needed. I may not be seeing it. So if he's put this in me, he's got a way. There may be a person that's a resource. But when I start to, you know, when you say it's not going to work, okay, it's not going to work. But... once I get clear that I want this, I'm ready to step in, I'm ready to move into what God has for me, to forgive, the resources show up, but they don't show up ahead of time. You know, I think that's the act of faith, is like, if I wait for all the pieces to come together, and then that's not probably going to happen. As I step forth, God opens up all these other things, like, wow, where did that come from? How many have experienced that? It's like there's abundance in it. Like, whew, I can't believe it. But I had to step into it, you know. So all the resources are already there. Yeah. If you have to go, you feel free to run. But there's a couple more questions. Yeah.
So kind of going back to what you're talking about, when like what kids need from adults and
yeah.
How
yeah.
When people like become believers and are like either still incarcerated or kind of working through like that, do you find like that like makes it really hard for them to see God as loving and trustworthy, and how do you like work with people on that?
Yeah, yeah, it sure does. You know, we see God through what we see other people through. So that's where I'm sort of stepping in as I'm not a surrogate God, but as a person that they can work out some of that. If I can't see it out here, how can I see it up into there? Yeah, definitely. For sure, yes.
I was going to ask how you would kind of combine helping people like claim their part of being a victim, but also helping them be understood, and that people aren't nonsense
Yeah. Yeah, so shame doesn't work well in this model, you know. So if I got to be bad, broken, shame, then I'm going to resist it. If it's an opportunity to move toward more freedom and power, then like give it a try, you know. That's why I say you don't even have to believe the story that you have a responsibility. So no shame, like in what happened, you did the best. It's a survival mechanism. Every the Bible calls them strongholds, you know. It's what gets you through, but then it keeps you locked in there. So Egypt, the word is stronghold, one of the definitions of Egypt. It was a place of protection for Joseph and his family. Then it became a prison. And then when they moved into the promised land, they still had a stronghold, of a way they were looking at it. They had to be retrained to live in freedom. And part of that is, so I think if you can open up the possibility and be vulnerable yourself with your own story, then, you know, it gives people something to try out, you know. And usually you got to be pretty desperate, because I've done the 12 steps, and that step four is that's a step, man. And I use it all the time when I'm stuck, you know, start to do a resentment inventory. Because I don't want to be stuck anymore. I don't want to give the power to the person I'm most despising. Otherwise, they're running my life, right? They might even be dead. But if I want to be free from that, there's another ending to the story that might be a lot more fruitful and as true or more true than the other one. Yeah. Yes, sir.
Yeah, I think one of the things that was really encouraging in the beginning was when you showed the pictures of a lot of those men and women that you've been working with for a long time and seeing how God has changed them and transformed them and where they're at now. I guess I would go out on a limb and say that maybe that wasn't the case for every single person that you
yeah.
with.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Kind of like reflecting back and looking at like the things that worked out, but maybe when you're in the beginning and you haven't maybe seen kind of the other side, the grass being greener on the other side.
Yeah.
With some of the time put in, what were some things that helped you be able to like suffer, someone leaving your life or just kind of rejecting God?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, certainly there's been a lot more funerals than weddings, but a lot of tragedy, and the ones you think are going to really grab don't. And so I do think it's, I've learned the process of mourning, which is, I wish I could have talked about that. Mourning is a biblical concept. Blessed are those who mourn. It's 100 and some times. I don't think we have taught how to be sad and to mourn. And this is a mourning ministry. There's a lot to mourn. It hasn't turned out. And that's a really, really good question. I don't know. I'm still doing it 34 years later, and I still have a love for these kids. I can't. That's never changed. I don't know. If it does, I'll do something else. You know, I think I will. But and I'm not. I'm pouring more of my life now into those who've come up through who are doing the work. I think more effectively than I could do it. But I'm still staying in with some. All the time, and I'm learning. I'm still learning, and they're showing me things, and I'm still growing and still failing, and I think for that I'm grateful. Yeah. Yeah. One more. Oh, they're $10. If you have 10. Can take one or get them on our website. A lot of, if you do this book, there's questions at the end of every chapter. That's where you're going to get the most, I think, too, because it will move you into the processes like we just did here.
But I give my-
Give it to me. Yes, give it all to me. And if you want to use credit, I can get your card. Yeah, and I can do it on credit too. Thank you. Oh, here. I have a 10 to give you back.
Awesome.
So I want to just thank Brett and all of the folks here for having a vision to bring this together, and so grateful for, oh yeah. So let me just say a prayer over you. God, thank you for each person here and the gift that they are, and thank you for their courage to step in even to these exercises we've done, that they might be useful in the lives of these awesome young people and old people that you have us journey with. I pray a blessing on their day and in every way, and whatever you're wanting to bring out of all this stuff into their life now, just filter that and let the rest be shed. In Jesus' name, amen.
This study was recorded at Xenos Christian Fellowship and is copyrighted. You may freely copy and distribute it as long as you keep it intact and do not sell it.